I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Could you lower those signs, please? I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in.
What you just heard was an excerpt of Robert F. Kennedy addressing a crowd after the assassination of civil rights leader Martin Luther King on this edition of Parallax Views. In light of the upsetting death of George Floyd and the wave of intense protests against police brutality and racism that it has sparked, we delve into the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. It would appear that the battles fought by civil rights leaders like King have yet to be fully won, even in the 21st century. And that is why King must still be remembered today. Joining us on this edition of the program is returning guest Stuart Wexler, a history teacher and author who previously spoke to us about his book, America's Secret Jihad, The Hidden History of Religious Terrorism in the United States. This time, Stuart tells us about the book he co-wrote with Larry Hancock, entitled Killing King, Racial Terrorists, James Earl Ray, and the Plot to Assassinate Martin Luther King Jr. On April 4th, 1968, in Memphis, Tennessee, Martin Luther King was fatally shot at the Lorraine Motel by James Earl Ray. In 1969, Ray confessed to the crime, was convicted, and sentenced to 99 years in prison. One would assume that that would be the end of the story. However, for some, questions still linger. In the years following his conviction, James Earl Ray would go on to recant his confession, claiming that the assassination was actually the result of a conspiracy. Additionally, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, formed in the 1970s, argued that the King assassination was likely the result of a conspiracy. But, of course, there are some who steadfastly believe that King's execution was an act of state carried out by the United States federal government. Most notable among them is William Pepper, attorney, activist and friend of Martin Luther King Jr. Larry Hancock and Stuart Wexler take a completely different look at the case that in some ways lines up with the House Select Committee's own investigation, while ultimately being at odds with the William Pepper interpretation of the assassination. In Killing King, Racial Terrorists, James Earl Ray, and the Plot to Assassinate Martin Luther King Jr., Wexler and Hancock make the case that James Earl Ray is not by any means an innocent man. However, they also argue that Ray was but only one cog in a conspiracy to assassinate America's most beloved civil rights leader that leads not to the federal government, but rather a network of white supremacist terrorists following a bizarre and esoteric racist religious theology that called upon them to ignite an apocalyptic racial holy war. Moreover, King and Wexler also believe that this alleged network of fanatical extremists were also involved in other incidents of racial terror, such as the Mississippi burning. I'll let you, the listener, decide for yourself if they make a strong enough case. But with all that being said, why don't we jump right into the conversation with Stuart Wexler as he takes us down a labyrinth of figures and organizations such as the KKK, the Dixie Mafia, a segregationist attorney who was convicted of a 1958 Alabama church bombing, and others whom Wexler and his co-author Larry Hancock argue were involved in the murder of America's most beloved civil rights leader in Killing King. Racial Terrorists, James Earl Ray, and the Plot to Assassinate Martin Luther King Jr. But first, a word from our sponsor.
My name is Joseph L. Flatley, and I'm a journalist who specializes in conspiracy theories and fringe culture. Over the years, I've met cultists and occultists, flat earthers, and doomsday bunker salesmen, to name only a few. One thing I hear often is that the end of the world is near, and these days, you have to wonder if there might be some truth to that. My new podcast is called Failed State Update. Through interviews and original reporting, each episode asks the question, is the world ending, or does it just seem like it is? Think of it as fresh air for the Orwellian dystopia we've suddenly found ourselves in. Available now on iTunes, Spotify, Anchor, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Parallax Views. Stuart Wexler, co-author of Killing King, Racial Terrorists, James Earl Ray, and the Plot to Assassinate Martin Luther King. You co-wrote this with the great Larry Hancock, who has also done a lot of interesting research into issues related to covert operations. This book is rather interesting, but I'm sure someone out there is saying, well, what more can be said about the King assassination? Martin Luther King was assassinated by James Earl Ray, and that's that.
So what I would argue, and it's sort of the big headline, would be that ultimately the King assassination was an act of religious terrorism. One of the first, actually, although my argument is in other books, is that it goes back a little bit further than that. Certainly one of the first major acts of religious terrorism in American history. And so James Earl Ray, though we definitely figure him prominently into what ultimately happened, is him being in Memphis as a byproduct of that plot by religious terrorists. And so that's sort of the big headline, and I think would be eye-opening for a lot of people to try and break that down, figure out why that was the case. That was the point of the book, to sort of justify that thesis.
So for folks that may not be familiar, I think everyone knows Martin Luther King, the great civil rights activist. How did he die? What's the, like, I guess, the official story? What happens?
So he is actually in the midst, in 1968, of his latest major initiative, which was the Poor People's Campaign. So he had been interested in, for a while, but sort of issues of segregation and Jim Crow were more of his focus earlier on in his career. But more and more by the late 1960s, Martin Luther King was devoted to trying to get at some of the underlying socioeconomic causes behind racism.
I was going to say, I think a lot of times we forget, or we're not even, you know, necessarily told in school, how King thought that the civil rights struggle, the anti-war struggle, and the socioeconomic struggle are all sort of connected.
They were all very much interconnected. So, you know, he has moral principled reasons for being against the Vietnam War, but he also has very practical reasons for being against the Vietnam War. And that's because the Vietnam War is draining resources that should have been spent, in his mind, on another war, which would have been the war on poverty. So he was in favor of something like a 300% increase in the war on poverty. And obviously that's being drained towards a war, which just on principle, I mean, he's a pacifist, he's opposed to. And of course, poverty is greatly intersected with the issues of race, because even after he succeeded in getting a lot of the de jure legal barriers to racial integration removed, and not just him, it was really a grassroots movement, it was really a bottoms-up movement. You know, for people on in northern cities, for people on the West Coast, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act did virtually nothing, certainly not in the short term. And so what's the still ongoing problem? If you can't move out of your neighborhood if you can't get a loan, you can't, you know, find, you know, true measure of equality if you can't get a job. So all of these things are greatly, certainly in King's mind, I wouldn't disagree with him, they're all greatly intertwined with each other. And so when he's in Memphis on the day he dies on April 4th, he's actually in the second go around of trying to lend his support to a labor strike in Memphis. It wasn't overtly a civil rights issue, although the Memphis sanitation workers were, and as an illustration of his point, by an overwhelming majority were people of color. So he's there. He wasn't even it's sort of a diversion. He was convinced to go there. The initial trip did not end the way he wanted to. A lot of people don't know that the Poor People's Campaign was kind of floundering. And here he was ready to try and lead people on a march from Mississippi to Washington, D.C. for basically to camp out there. And he's got a situation where he goes to Memphis to try and lend his name to a labor strike, and a labor strike turns violent. And this is towards the end of March. So he's coming back late March, early April, to try and demonstrate one more time to the American public that nonviolence can work. And he's going to lead a nonviolent, or try to lead a nonviolent, labor strike, or be a part of that strike. Again, he didn't start that strike. He was sort of lending his support to it.
And I want to add something in here. At this point in time, King was not necessarily this universally loved figure. Even within the Black community, there were some people in the Black community that didn't think he was militant enough. There were white folks that believed he was too militant. Yeah,
that's a huge part of the argument we make in our book that we'll probably get into even more later on, as to why the conventional conspiratorial narrative advanced by people like William Pepper doesn't really hold very well. Because King wasn't, in 1968, as you said, certainly with the white community. Polls showed a large majority of white Americans had lost their esteem for Martin Luther King. But even, and to a lesser extent, within the Black community, he was losing traction, as you said. In the white community, as you said, he was seen from the time he started turning, especially against the war, but even more so when he is demanding levels of economic intervention during the Cold War that, you know, is too far for even liberal America to go to. He's turning those folks off. And he's talking about programs that are more in line with, say, a Bernie Sanders nowadays than, and to some extent, Andrew Yang, than the programs that are being offered by even Joe Biden nowadays, right? So he's fallen outside of the economic and foreign policy mainstream for a lot of liberals, white liberals. And in the Black community, as you said, there was increasingly a shift away out of frustration for the very reasons I said, because especially on the West Coast and in northern cities, the civil rights movement was largely illusory for them in terms of what it meant in terms of tangible life benefits. But even in the South, I mean, you can go to the same school as a white person, but you can't get a promotion, can't get a loan. You know, it's still not fully realized. And King knew that. It was being brought home to him when he started confronting Northern racism. You know, he was having rocks thrown at him. The death threats continued. And so he was very much at the low ebb of his influence and popularity when he's in Memphis on the day he's killed. And that's partially why the Poor People's Campaign is floundering. That's partially why he's getting resistance and feels as if he has to prove the value of nonviolence, because he's in an environment where even people who would have potentially been natural allies to him are getting frustrated with what nonviolence has achieved. And that's where we are on April 4th, when he is on the second floor of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, in a room he shares frequently with his right-hand man, Reverend Ralph Abernathy. And around 6 p.m., he's been in and out of the room throughout the day. He smokes, for instance. Around 6 p.m., he's coming out because they're going to go eat. And at that point, a shot rings out, and he is struck dead from a shot that basically goes through his neck, jaw area.
And that's James Earl Ray, is the fatal shooter.
Well, okay, the official version, then we'll get to my version, which is a little bit more elaborate, but not as far off as one might think. Yes, so at that point, there's an escape. Somebody escapes from the building across the street. There's great controversy, we could discuss it, about where the shot came from. But what we do know is somebody, without question, everybody agrees with this, somebody ran out of Bessie Brewer's rooming house across the street. And then somebody drops a package outside a amusement sort of gaming shop at the rear of Bessie Brewer's, or I should say at the opposite end from where the Lorraine is. And whoever that person is, they flee. Again, I'll make my assertion as to who it is later. And for weeks and months, the FBI is and the Memphis police are in a, especially the FBI, are in a massive, unprecedented manhunt. And at first they thought it was for as many as three people. And then over time, the various aliases that trace to that package and the items in that package, including a rifle, outside that amusement store, the Canopy's Amusement, they figure out that they're for aliases that all lead to the same person, escaped prisoner who had escaped a Missouri prison in 1967 by the name of James Earl Ray. And, you know, again, several months later, in June, he is eventually caught in England at an airport trying to get out of England and go into Belgium. He ultimately wants to go to Rhodesia. And so they capture James Earl Ray, bring him, extradite him to the United States, and he is tried within several months after that. And he kind of pleads guilty and then recants. And that sort of sets the stage because he says he was sort of snookered into that, what amounts to a guilty plea. And then from that point forward, he proceeds to tell a story of how he was completely set up to be a fall guy for a shooting that he had no idea was going to happen and that he had nothing to do with.
Now, I want to get into that recantation, but first I want to say I don't consider the theory you put forth in this book to be a really – it's not like a grand conspiracy narrative.
Not even close.
Much yeah. more compact, I guess, maybe the word. And I think that lends some believability to it. The other thing I want to note is that you and Larry Hancock are not the first people to say, oh, there was more to this assassination than James Earl Ray. I believe the House Select Committee on Assassinations also said this. Could you tell my listeners about that?
So sure. There was the trial in 1968 and really 1969, and James Earl Ray goes to federal prison. And then after that point, 10 years later, after we have Watergate and revelations about FBI surveillance programs and CIA assassination programs, there's a push to reopen based on ongoing questions. I mean, people have been questioning it since the day it happened. Both the Kennedy and the King, John Kennedy, and Martin Luther King's assassination by the House. And so we get the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and they're going to ultimately conclude that James Earl Ray was likely the main participant, but in response to a bounty offer from racist organization. And we are very closely aligned, except we have a different idea as to who that racist organization is and what their motives were. And that's the fundamental difference. Is we don't believe that they got they identified the right group of people as having offered a bounty offer on King that Ray responded to. Also, we don't believe Ray was supposed to be the person or persons who were going to be the shooters, as we can get to if you want to get to later on. We believe that the way to completely explain the evidence and the behaviors of various parties in this case is that Ray literally and figuratively jumped the gun. He was on the periphery of this white supremacist, and as I will argue, again, we'll get to it later, religious terrorist plot, and being the sort of greedy and somewhat impulsive person that he was, he essentially preempted what was really supposed to happen.
And I want to note, so you would argue that Ray wasn't necessarily driven by things like racism. It was more he was an opportunist. He was a greedy sort of, I want my money now type guy.
He had, like many, many people who grew up in the Jim Crow South, he had, racist ideas. He very likely was not a fan of Martin Luther King, almost definitely wasn't. But that's not what motivates James Earl Ray to do.
So it's not the primary motivation.
Right. Probably. By far, okay. The biggest motivation is he wants to make money. And we believe that's what happened here was he was on the periphery of a plot and either received or was set to receive a small fraction of a large bounty. And he decided, or somewhat impulsively, to try and take advantage of exploit the situation and try and get a much larger portion of the same bounty by doing the big deed instead of the little deed. The little deed would have been stalking King, bringing the weapon to the people who were supposed to do the job. It wasn't to have James Earl Ray shoot King, but James Earl Ray saw an opportunity and exploited that. But again, he never would have been there and done the things he was doing. And he could have received money from this group, small amount of it before. He wouldn't have been doing what he was doing without this racial terrorist plot against King that he was supposed to be a peripheral player in.
Now, so, this wasn't the first bounty that was raised against King, was it?
No, and in fact, that's a big part of what our book does, is we show that there was more than one bounty that was being put on King's head. And in fact, if you look behind those bounties, they lead to the people who are circling around the one offer that we really focus on, that we have an inside source on, from 1967. So there had been more than one bounty put on Martin Luther King's head, and the price kept on going up. And by 1967, it was up to $100,000. But all the previous bounties, the people were almost to a person, 1 to 2 steps removed from each other. That got missed by the House. That was one of the big things that the House Select Committee didn't put together. They had a lot of these individual people or groups identified as being motivated and actually attempting to try and kill King. They didn't get all of the plots, but they got a lot of them. What they failed to see was the interconnectivity between the groups and the fact that what united all of them was an ideology. And that's why I say it's a racial, a religious terrorist plot. It was what we would now call an accelerationist plot by a certain subset of white supremacists who wanted to start a race war. And you get there by working from the ground up. I mean, one of the first things you do in any murder investigation is you ask the people who knew the victim, were there any enemies? Did anybody else try and do something or have done something towards this victim? If you ask that question on the King assassination, you keep on coming back to the same people. And not coincidentally, there's then direct evidence that those people were actually, or trying to do it in 67 and on through 68, and, very, very likely did it on April 4th.
I want to get back to those previous attempts on King's life. But first, the one thing I really want to get into with regards to James Earl Ray is when he recants to some degree or another, he starts talking about this character, Raoul. Who is this Raoul character? I know a lot of people will say, oh, he's lying, it's all made up. You and Larry have a very interesting take on this Raoul character. And for my listeners that don't know, maybe you could explain what this is about.
So almost within days of more or less confessing, although I would, if you listen to it, he implied to the judge that other people were involved. But almost to within days, he starts talking about how he was manipulated, like puppet master type stuff, without any understanding or idea as to what he was being manipulated for. but with a very clear understanding about, well, not very clear, but he did have a very good idea as to who the person who was manipulating him was. And it was a character who identified in him to himself, to James Earl Ray, as Raoul. And Raoul is, to be quite honest with you, James Earl Ray gives multiple physical type of descriptions of Raoul, from being a French Canadian to being Cuban to being, you know, American Indian and different color hair. And a lot of people, and I think with good reason, I think I think that Raoul, if he existed, was a composite. And more than one person says that. The difference between Larry and I is, first of all, we're not certain of that. What we are certain of is Raoul was a diversion, that Ray used this character to try and push blame somewhere else, because he's trying a double game, James Earl Ray. And maybe we'll talk again more about it later, but in the big picture, once he's in prison, James Earl Ray has two things on his mind. He needs to get out, but he still wants his money. And so the only way he gets out is by pushing the blame onto somebody else. But the only way he gets his money is to push it onto somebody else who wasn't really behind the conspiracy. So he invents this international man of mystery known as Raoul. And again, Raoul may very well be a conglomeration of various people that Ray interacted with. Jules Rico Kimball, who just recently died, fits some of the description. Union Klan member from Louisiana who was in Canada at the relevant times with Ray. We identified a guy who met with Ray. He's been in literature before, but we actually figured out who his name was. His name was James Wilburn Ashmore. He was a criminal within, very likely with connections to the Dixie Mafia. So Ray likely was putting together this false narrative, something he had done before. We actually know he did the exact same thing, invented a person to take the blame for his crime in previous cases where he was convicted for the crime. And so it's not new for James Earl Ray. Other people have done it before, of course, as well. You just make up a fictitious person and place all the blame and the culpability on them. Again, that's not to say that something like Raoul, or a group of people, I should say, didn't exist. But for Ray, the primary purpose of Raoul, this character he puts into the story and who he changes up, and I could discuss that quite a bit, the primary purpose is to get the blame off of him so he can get out of prison without implicating the people who could potentially pay him the money that he never collected.
Now, this seems like a kind of effort that's not just constructed by Ray, but requires a bit of a teamwork. Like, who what's his legal defense look like after he gets picked up in London?
So that's a real interesting thing that doesn't get nearly as much attention, Casey, is the fact that Ray's got two different sets of lawyers, basically, into two groups. He's got sort of new left type of attorneys, people like Mark Lane and James Lessar. And then he's got a lot of racist attorneys against the advice of people like Jim Lessar and Mark Lane and Harold Weisberg. And, you know, Ray is desperately trying to present himself as not being racist, and yet he associates himself with some of the worst racists. The attorney who's probably of the most interest to us is a guy by the name of J.B. Stoner, who is a racial terrorist and an attorney himself who represented racial terrorists. So, you know, I say, and I don't think it's much of an exaggeration, J.B. Stoner either was connected to or represented virtually every major racist act. Represented those who were accused of virtually every racist act in the country in one way, shape, or form as either their attorney or their appeals attorney. He had more of an appellate function for James Earl Ray, but there's no reason you bring him on. He brought on later on a guy who is known, Jack Kershaw, for having sculpted a statue, a really bad sculpture, of Nathaniel Bedford Forrest in Nashville. He has at least three or four other attorneys who have really like well-known racist bona fides. He tries for others. And it's entirely possible, I think very likely, because I believe Stoner, I can talk about this later, very likely at least had foreknowledge, if he wasn't directly involved in the King assassination, that certainly somebody like Stoner or somebody else, maybe James Earl Ray's brothers, could have potentially helped him come up with this idea. But again, Ray was more crafty than we give him credit for. I mean, he already had done something like this on his own in the past. So, you know, a lot of the things that people act like, oh my goodness, James Earl Ray could never have done this, it must be the CIA, James Earl Ray admitted doing. Like the fake identifications. He admitted doing that, that he came up with the fake names and the fake identifications in Canada. So he could have had help with it. I am confident that he tried to use these racist attorneys as sort of a signal, at the very least, if not a conduit, almost like mob attorneys, to the people who could get him eventually the bounty. His hope, I think, to the day he died, that he could get out and get the money he never fully received.
I guess the objection to that would be, why would someone go to that much trouble just to get this bounty? I mean, he's in jail. He's not getting out. Why wouldn't he just spill the beans? I mean, is the bounty really worth it?
I think he thought he was getting out. I think he thought that, especially with the people who were in his ear, that he was going to get out. I mean, he had people writing best-selling books. He had Dick Gregory. He had Mark Lane on his side. I think in his own mind, he thought he could get out of this. And by the way, not by way of legal, by way of escape, which he actually at one point tried to do and you know, got out of a federal penitentiary. It's a second prison escape, which is, again, the people who paint him out to be this just rube. Rubes don't escape prison systems twice. You got to be pretty crafty. So, again, I think, first off, the sense I got, and it's actually, there's a sense, there's a, one of the things we brought forward, but it's actually came from a 2011 revelation in the papers out of Memphis, the commercial appeal, was that Ray, there was a note found when Ray was, after Ray met with, I believe it was Stoner, and in it he said, I did all of this for $10,000, no more fool pants. And it was in his handwriting, clearly indicating that he was doing something for money. So for the people who think he was just, you know, some, you know, racist, you know, crusader, the fact that he put it, but the other element, the sort of way you can read off of that is that he's pissed off that he went through going for, he's in prison for only $10,000. Meanwhile, in the back of his mind, he's thinking there's $90,000 more that should be in my bank account somewhere. And again, in 1967, 1968, that's $800,000 in today's money. And, you know, if he was released in 74 or 75, it wouldn't have been much different. So I think he's someone whose whole life has been motivated by money. He didn't think he was going to get caught. And if he got caught, he had people in his ear convincing him that he could get out. And so he's thinking, I could get out, and if I do this the right way, I can push the blame on somebody else, get out, and get the money that I've deserved since the day I've been in here.
Now let's back up to J.B. Stoner, and let's use J.B. Stoner to look at the wider sort of network that you're talking about in the book. J.B. Stoner is one bad, bad dude. I mean, you know, you would think by the way he presents himself that he's just some, you know, I hate to use this word. Yeah. Bumpkin. But he's fairly intelligent. He's an attorney. He has some very odd views, even by the standards of racists at that time. You know, the KKK, we think of them as, you know, hating black people. But Stoner went farther. Stoner believed that Jews were like the children or the synagogue of Satan. There's a lot more going on with Stoner and some of the other figures in your book than just this hatred of the black community.
So Stoner is somebody who, as a teenager, tried to communicate with a Nazi propagandist in Europe. He was pro-Nazi in the United States, in Georgia, during World War II. After World War II, he gets involved with a group called the Columbians, who I would argue to people the first acceleration. Accelerationists are people who think that there's going to be a race war, and we'll get a little bit more into that in a second, and feel as if they can actually make it happen. A lot of the modern terrorism we see, even if they're from different intellectual strains from maybe J.B. Stoner, are people who think that they can do it, and very recent ones. They think that they can kill people like Dylann Roof and create enough antagonism between groups that they can create, that they can, you know, provoke a race war. And that's a key thing, and we're gonna maybe get much more in depth with that. Stoner, he gets involved with this group, the Columbians, and they are right out there collecting, stockpiling weapons. It's like straight out of a modern terrorist group, straight out of the what's the name of the group that was just sort of put down, the big giant group with that the FBI had infiltrated and arrested people from, the base, right? Mm-hmm. Very much like that, not as big, but in out of Georgia, this group that was trying right at the end of World War II to foment a race war. But as you said, this group, the Columbians, they had their attention not just at blacks, and in many ways, they saw Jews as the bigger enemy. And the reason why is right at the end of World War II is a consolidation of a lot of different strains of racist thought into something that we now call Christian identity, which are groups of people who believe that for centuries, Jews have been part of a cosmic conspiracy against white Europeans, that they're really the children of the devil.
And that the white Europeans are the true Israelites.
White Europeans are the true chosen people, that there were two sexual interactions, not to get too off track, in the Garden of Eden, and that Jews are the children of the devil and Eve.
The serpent seed line, I think, is their
correct
little name for
There's
it.
There's two seed line, we call it, and the second seed line goes, the seed line that creates white Europeans goes from Adam and Eve to Seth, if you know your Old Testament, and then takes you on further to, you know, Noah, etc. The seed line that comes from, that is hard to identify because it's a pretty bizarre interpretation of the book of Genesis, there is another relationship. This is between Eve and the serpent, according to these folks, and that produces the Jews that would be called Jews nowadays, but are really, according to these folks, imposters, Ashkenazi Jews, people from Eastern Europe, and that for centuries, these demonic Jews in this thought process have been working against white Europeans as part of a cosmic conspiracy, and that what you're accelerating is the end times, and for them, the end times is a race war. So the book of Revelations, the last book of the Bible, is describing a race war, according to these folks in Christian identity. And the Columbians were the first group to really have show that they were influenced, probably by way of Canada. And there's gets ignored, but it's clearly there if you study into them in any depth. Stoner as a very young man and another person who he becomes lifelong friends with, Ed Fields, and a couple of other people, but those are the two main ones. They come out of the Colombians radicalized. The Colombians are shut down, their plot to create a race war, which is, again, all of them are kind of ridiculous, but they believe that they can make it happen. The Colombians are shut down by way of law enforcement, but people like Stoner and Ed Fields emerge from that as sort of the early adapters of Christian identity. And so Stoner, as you said, is unique within white supremacist circles. Most white supremacists don't have this kind of ideological bent to them. If you're a Klan member, your goal is to preserve the Southern way of life. It's would be a secular nationalist type of goal if you talk in terms of the way we classify terrorists. Stoner and Fields, they are ideological and religiously motivated.
And for members of the KKK, they look at people like Stoner and Fields and are saying, well, yeah, I mean, we don't like the Jews that much, but the real problem are these black people. What are you guys talking about? This is a little bit much.
They get thrown out. So Stoner actually tries to, you know, it was a Kentucky Ku Klux Klan group. They're like, why are you obsessed with Jews? Our issue is with blacks. And even in the late 40s, they're kicking him out. And he can't find a foothold in Klan groups and at the same time get them to do what he wants. And that's going to be important later on, because what happens in the 50s is people like Stoner and Fields, they form at first a group called the Christian Anti-Jewish Party. And then they form a group called the National States Rights Party.
Because the first one was a bit on the nose.
Yeah. Now they have these sort of politically sounding names, but by all accounts, and I don't think it's even disputable, the National States Rights Party is far more radical and violent and, you know, sort of dangerous than the Klan. In fact, you know, when I did my work on the Birmingham bombing, and I believe Stoner had something to do with it, I think he's the one guy who really got away with it. The group that pulled off the Birmingham bombing was a Klan group that was being shunned, the Eastview Clavern, because they were associating with Stoner and Stoner was too radical. They were associating with the National States Rights Party. And so these guys, they have to form their own groups because they can't get conventional Klan groups to at least, like, in their minds, why don't you just go after Jews also? Like, and they're like, what is your obsession with Jews, right? Rhetorically, Klan groups were plenty anti-Semitic, but during the civil rights movement, they were certainly much more concerned with, you know, preserving Jim Crow and preserving segregation. So Stoner forms these separate groups, and to the extent that he and others like him who are under this influence of Christian identity, that they interact with other groups, it's by hiding their bigger agenda. And that sounds crazy to people, but I always try and use two or three analogies. For the sports people out there, it's like the coach who takes a team on when he knows that his goal is to go into the NFL. He's coaching a college team, and his eyes are towards the NFL. If you looked at how he operated, he's still trying to win games, but he's running the team with an alternative agenda. You can find a similar, and that's super common if you follow college sports, but in politics, oftentimes people join political campaigns as advisors. They don't really care if the person ultimately wins. If they do a good job with that person, they're making money and they're setting themselves up to work in other campaigns. None of them would ever say that, but that's how they operate. It's the principal agent problem. But the more direct relationship would be to look at ISIS over the last few years and look at who was running things, who was in the administrative functions in ISIS. It was Ba'ath Party members. old political parties from within the Iraqi sort of power elite, and they lost their power after America invaded. They're a secular political party. They're using ISIS as a means of getting political and economic power back. They're not, you know, radical Salafi jihadists. That's kind of the way Stoner operates throughout the 60s.
It's the game of we can use these people as useful idiots to get our ends.
And that's exactly what it is. And so even within the National States Rights Party, if you look at the leadership, and this is what I would argue, on one of these days, I'm going to do a much better job of promoting my older books, but National States Rights Party is unquestionably, if you look at their leadership, a religious terrorist organization. Pretty much every senior member is a devotee of Christian Identity under the leadership of somebody we may talk about, Wesley Swift. The person they choose is their, so you got Stoner, you got Fields, you got John Crommelin. The person they choose to be their pastor, Gordon Winrod, is like the godfather. His family is the first family of Christian Identity. That's who their pastor was, their chosen pastor. Their East Coast leader was Reverend Orrin Petito, right? He's a reverend in the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, which is a Christian Identity church. Their West Coast leader is Reverend Connie Lynch. He is an ordained minister in the Christian Identity church. They do a lot of, those two, by the way, do a lot of what we call nowadays stochastic terrorism, go around inciting people. Petito is maybe the leader, one of the two big leaders in trying to ignite the violence at Ole Miss. And unfortunately, Connie Lynch was almost like a master at getting people riled up to go do immediate actual violence with his speeches. And who did he travel the country with? J.B. Stoner. And all of them, and the groups like the National States Rights Party, they have their hands in other plots against King prior to 1967.
Just to make clear, what are some of the other terrorist activities that you would say we can undeniably connect this sort of network of Christian Identity people to?
So the first major wave of anti-Jewish terrorism in American history is a series of coordinated bombings against Jewish and Black targets. Unfortunately, as we know, the targeting of Black targets is not all that uncommon. But to have a wave of bombings of synagogues and Jewish community centers in the late 1950s was a real eye-opener. I dug very deep into the history of anti-Semitic violence and could find virtually no coordinated campaigns until 1957. I found none. 57, you get a coordinated campaign, and 58. And it's the National States Rights Party. Stoner's behind it. The people who were brought in for arrest all said it was him, but then they got another person who's going to become important later on, a guy named James Venable, who is Stoner's law partner, comes and becomes their defense attorney, and suddenly their stories all change. But all the internal evidence points to Stoner as being the master bomb maker and the mastermind of the whole plot. By 1960, Senator Keating, I forget his first name, it's bad of me, is on the floor of the United States Congress basically listing, I think, as many as 16 different terrorist attacks attributable to the National States Rights Party. And that's the stuff they actually, you know, pull off or actually comes to fruition. If you look at the stuff they tried to do in the 1960s, I mean, it would have led to mass carnage if they weren't caught. I mean, when in September of 1963, before the Birmingham bombing, which I think they had something to do with, Stoner was pulled aside, well, not Stoner, but a caravan of racists that Stoner had organized were pulled aside on the on their way to a counter-protest in 1963, and they had machetes and, you know, all kinds of crazy weaponry that they were going to use on protesters there. By the way, you know, everybody always talks about the Ku Klux Klan and the violence that was visited on the Freedom Riders. But look at some of the people who were the most active in those plots. They at least had co-membership in the National States Rights Party. So, again, they were involved in a number of attacks. They planned a number of attacks that didn't come to fruition. Stoner himself was involved in a number of bombings. And, you know, by 1965, the Attorney General from California has identified Stoner as and the National States Rights Party as one of the worst terrorist organizations in the country. He also identifies a number of other groups who are co-affiliated with each other, almost all of them at their leadership ranks are people who are devout Christian identity believers.
So in the face of all this, like the state attorney general takes notice of these terrorist organizations. So what does the Federal Bureau of Investigation do with this information?
So they're definitely concerned with these groups, but the issue is for them is that throughout the late 50s and early 60s especially, and I'm not trying to give a free pass to J. Edgar Hoover here, is one of my least favorite figures in American history.
He's a pretty monstrous figure.
But I can at least understand, I don't approve long-term, but I can understand part of his issue throughout the 60s is FBI, murder is not a federal offense. Virtually none of the crimes, unless you're willing to use as the Department of Justice, and they weren't willing to really use it until the late 1960s, civil rights laws, arson's not a federal offense. Blowing stuff up is not a federal offense unless you're using stuff across state lines. And so part of the problem for groups, they recognized how dangerous some of these groups were, you can't do much about them because it's a state-level prosecution that needs to happen. And so what they do is they infiltrate these groups, but then they choose to protect their informants, because if they try and help a local prosecutor with the way the criminal justice system works in, say, Alabama, the people are going to be acquitted, and you're going to lose your informant. And then, and this is where I start to have big problems with them, then it becomes hiding the fact that you had an informant in these groups. Right? That's what it becomes, you know, in 66 and 67, all the way into the 70s, is you don't want to admit that you solved these cases with your informants and didn't do anything about it. So it becomes this sort of circular, I don't even know what to call it, but it's not good. But they were definitely aware of how bad these people were. They just were somewhat impotent to do anything about it until maybe the late 1960s.
And it's not like these groups also didn't, I'm sorry to interrupt you. It's
no,
not
no,
like
no,
these
ahead.
Groups didn't, like, I'm reminded of one instance in the book where you talk about a car driving a car full of FBI agents off the road, and one of them gets slapped in the face at gunpoint.
Right. So in there's one place, more than any other by far, that becomes sort of this, where the FBI really goes at it with these people, and that's Mississippi. And part of the issue is that it's the same thing, and to some extent, is that they can't get local prosecution, and you can't get convicted for basically any racist crime in Mississippi. If you're a racist down there, you're pretty much almost like have an immunity card. The FBI had already been, surveilling these folks, and the people in Mississippi were as radical as any group in the country. Instead of just, you know, putting up with the FBI tailing them, they start tailing the people in the FBI and run them off the road, confront them with shotguns. One of them strikes an FBI agent, and there's virtually nothing the FBI can do about it. And so then you have in Mississippi something that you have that's directed at groups like the Black Panthers in other parts of the country. It is hands-off, practically vigilantism between the FBI in Mississippi, the Jackson Field Office, and the Ku Klux Klan there. I mean, they're...
Samuel Bowers, right?
And that's KKK where guy. You get to Sam Bowers, who is also Christian identity. And the one thing I've done in more than one of my books is show people who know him well will tell you, oh, yeah, he was Christian identity, you know, and they'll say definitely by 1967, and I'm able to establish that he was Christian identity as of 1964. And in fact, the Mississippi burning killings were for him part of that kind of Christian identity. Let's see if I can accelerate something, get a race war going. It wasn't for the rank and file, and that's always important to reemphasize. Once you get past leadership, and it wasn't even by, you know, it wasn't, you know, fully penetrating all leadership either. Once you get past leadership, they're rank and file racists who, you know, want to keep, you know, the pool segregated and the school segregated. It's the people at the top, and Bowers is the most blatant about that. I mean, he's actually quoted by someone who was an informant inside the White Knights as saying, the average Mississippi redneck doesn't know what the heck he's doing. I have to use them for my own plans. And then he outlines what those plans are, and it's to create a race war.
So in this regard, getting back to the MLK assassination, we have these networks of really strange Christian identity people. I believe we also have the Dixie Mafia, which I knew about the Dixie Mafia because of the movie Walking Tall, original one with Joe Don Baker. They remade it with The Rock a while back. But who are the Dixie Mafia and how do they tie into this strange story?
Okay, so the Dixie Mafia, it's actually one of the worst labels in terms of giving you elucidation on what they are than you can have, because they're not all that Dixie, and they're very different from the Sicilian Mafia. So they're a group of they're a group of almost like criminal gangster types of almost rogue type gangsters who form informal partnerships with each other, like gangs, almost like the you know, Jesse James type of situation back in, you know, the 1870s and 80s. And they often meet through prison system, and they have complementary skills. They're like a criminal A team. Right. And their goal is just to make money, but there's no hierarchy. There's no like Don with like, you know, lieutenants and consigliere.
They're more or less co-equals.
They're much more co-equal, and they're willing to go beyond oftentimes their little core group of, you know, sort of drinking buddies to outsiders who, you know, might be extra muscle to rob, you know, homes. And while there is certainly a concentration of them in Dixie, they're all throughout the Midwest, the Great Plains, and even on the West Coast. And starting in really the early 1960s, but especially by the mid to late 1960s, they're becoming a force in the criminal, sort of organized criminal world. The Mafia is starting to get prosecuted by people like Bobby Kennedy. These people are starting to move in on their turf in some respects. And they're in many ways less scrupulous than the Mafia. They're willing to kill, as in Walking Tall, that's based on a real story.
Buford Pusser,
Where Buford Pusser, his wife is killed, and most people believe that was an assassination attempt directed at Pusser. They kill a judge, they kill an attorney general. Whereas the regular Mafia kind of tends to stay away from law enforcement. Like, there's a little bit of a code. if you're in the way of a Dixie Mafia member and their money, you're in a lot of trouble. And by the 70s, they're being identified, in fact, as being even more dangerous and more of a problem than the conventional mafia in a lot of law enforcement sort of journals. And so what happens is groups like the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of Mississippi would use people in the Dixie Mafia as muscle for some of their enterprises and endeavors and for intimidation. And this is how you get from and the other thing to understand while you're understanding that is that by the late 1960s, the FBI, and I was kind of alluding to this before, the federal law enforcement is finally really going after some of these white supremacist groups and using civil rights related federal laws to go after them with. And in Mississippi, where I told you it was already super intense, it's more intense than it's ever been. The White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, who tried as many as four times to kill Martin Luther King, they're under constant surveillance. So if you're going to try and kill Martin Luther King and you're any one of these radical groups, you can't do it with your normal collection of white supremacists, certainly not in the normal typical way. And what you do instead is you reach out to outsiders. And we have evidence that they're doing that as early as 1964. I don't think it's evidence, it's definite that they reached out to White Knights, to the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of Mississippi, reached out to Dixie Mafia hitmen, including somebody who some people suspect killed Pusser's wife, as early as 1964, and that falls through. We show pretty clearly, through somebody who was directly within the plot, that they circulate that bounty, but with a much higher amount, to some of the same Dixie Mafia people in 1967. We have somebody still alive who was offered that in a prison, who was offered part of the bounty and was offered the role of somebody to scout King's movements, the role that we think Ray ultimately took. And what we show is that bounty, or bounties like it, broadly speaking, were circulating in the American prison system. And so Ray would have been familiar, maybe not with all the details, but his connection to these groups are through the Dixie Mafia people who were reaching out to people who were getting out of prison and making them offers to participate in a King plot.
In that regard, I was going to ask specifically about a character that comes up very early in the book, Donald Nissen?
Nissen. So Don Nissen was a career criminal. He was, you know, somebody who would do forgery. He was somebody who would do home robbery, you know, rob a nightclub. He was that kind of – he and his partner were not in the Dixie Mafia, but they were in – they knew people in those circles. And Don Nissen, we found him, or we found a report without his name in it from June of 1967, where somebody who is in jail for only a little while in Texas contacts the FBI in June of 1967 and says, "Hey, look, first off, if you could do something to get me out of here," and they tell him no right away. This is bogus, and it turned out to be bogus. But I need to get something to you folks that's more important than me being in here, because I don't want to be arrested for murder. And I'm here to tell you that there's a plot circulating in the prison I was at, Leavenworth, where a criminal who says he is responding to a bounty from the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of Mississippi offered me a role in the plot. And I didn't tell him no because I didn't want to die on my way before I got out of prison. But I didn't tell him yes either. And it would be great of you if you could shut this thing down before it gets out of hand.
This is a plot to kill King.
Yes, it's a $100,000 plot, bounty offered by the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, fronted to criminals to see if they would be willing to kill King. And again, you can't do it through your normal channels because you're all being watched. So you've got to do it through outsiders. The outsiders this time are criminals within the Dixie Mafia. So Nissen was offered this bounty on his way out of prison, on his way to Georgia, which is where King lives. So he's kind of offering to somebody to basically scat him out. He gives details on this plot. He names people who were offered as cutouts. And in some cases, if he doesn't know the name, he knows the address. And he provides that to the FBI. And a key thing is, I always emphasize to people, this is June of 1967. So this isn't what we find. It can't be what we find in political assassinations over and over again, where somebody is making up a story after the fact to try and make a name for themselves. With the Kennedy assassination, for instance, there's hundreds of those kinds of people. This is before the plot even happened. And so when the FBI does a really bad job of following up on that lead, they don't really take the lead seriously. They don't listen carefully enough to the people who they go to interview. They don't even interview some of the people who he implicates. And the key thing is, they don't cross-reference it with their own files. Now, Larry and I could do that with digital database searches. So I'll give the FBI a little bit of a pass on that. But in their own files, if they would have traced evidence of the same plot from 1964 having been sort of torpedoed, and it was simply being resurrected in 1967, they give up on it. Initially, Don Nissen goes to Atlanta, thinks there's nothing to anything, until somebody in who he works with approaches him and asks him to deliver a package to Mississippi. He delivers packages as a traveling salesman all the time, so he takes it up as a favor, no problem. When he gets back, he is told that that bounty was a bounty offer on what he delivered was actually the money for the bounty offer on Martin Luther King. And you'll say, why would somebody admit that to him? Because remember, Don Nissen never said no. So the person who gave him the money thought he was in somehow inside the plot. And that completely freaks Don Nissen out, especially after he's confronted, right? So the word of the FBI investigation actually gets back to the people, some group of people, probably Dixie Mafia in Georgia, and they basically threaten him and threaten his life. And that's when he goes on the run. He goes on the run before King is killed. But not long after King is killed, the FBI says, maybe we need to look at this plot because there's been a guy who's been missing, they think for days, in reality it's been months, who told us about a plot against King almost a year ago, and we don't know where the heck he is. So they go on an all-points mission to try and find a manhunt to find Don Nissen, and when he gets, eventually he turns himself in and tells them quite a bit of the story. I go into some detail, but the key is he gave them a heads up in advance, and they didn't take it. Had they combined that heads up in advance with an investigation of the kinds of things Ray was doing and with an investigation of the group involved that was implicated, especially both the Dixie Mafia and the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of Mississippi. And we believe that they may well have put some stuff together and realized we blew it because we could have stopped this in advance.
So the FBI, in other words, would have a reason to not want to sort of look at this because it makes them look bad.
So we argue, we give a lot of detail in the book about it, that by August of 1968, the FBI may very well have realized a few things, that they could have stopped the plot and that they had an informant inside of it.
Casey, do you have anything you want to add to that?
So we kept mentioning this $100,000 bounty, and we already got confirmation that Don Neeson inadvertently, at least according to his own words, dropped that money from one point to another.
Yes.
Where does that money come from?
Okay, so we established through work done by Lamar Waldron that we were able to confirm, especially in the recent book, even stuff we weren't able to include in the most recent edition, that the money was being raised in the Southeast, and especially in the Georgia area, likely by white supremacist business type people, including a person who's famous in Kennedy assassination literature by the name of Joseph Miltier. The way they kind of hid their fingerprints on it was they redirected the money from union dues at a auto factory in Georgia. And they were offering the money in Georgia to try and get King killed. But what ultimately happened was, is the group that had been the most successfully violent and committed group in the country, the White Knights, who had a connection and a relationship with the Dixie Mafia, that's who this white supremacist network ultimately went to. And it's getting back to some of the earlier stuff we were talking about. It's really important to think about this as a network that's you know, national in scope, and look at it as a religious terrorist organization. And the ideology that glues them together is Christian identity. And so what happens is people who are sympathetic to that idea in Georgia raise the money, and that money is then inadvertently, as you said, unwittingly transferred over to Mississippi, where it's going to be used, because the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan didn't have the money. The people in Georgia did. And that money is going to be used in a White Knights. So the White Knights are sort of the big picture people, and the Dixie Mafia are the mechanics. That's what that money is going to be used for, basically to pay off the Dixie Mafia to help the White Knights kill King in Memphis, if not in another city.
Now, there's other plots against King by white supremacists, but they have fallen through. Why did these other plots fall through?
In almost every instance, it's kind of good luck on the part of King. So King was notoriously unpredictable in his schedule. He would be late. He would cancel things at the last minute. He would change his route. He would change his itinerary. Some of that was probably done for safety reasons. Some of that is just a product of, I guess, the sort of character of the civil rights movement. So on multiple instances, he would have been killed if he had simply, you know, gone to the place where he wanted to, where they thought he would go. And it got to a point that by the mid to late 60s, they started trying to figure out how to lure King into places to kill him. So there was a killing of a black farmer named Ben Chester White by the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of Mississippi in the late 1960s. I think it was 66. And we only found out when these guys finally got successfully prosecuted that the whole point of killing Ben Chester White was to divert King away from the March Against Fear and get him to come to another part of Mississippi so that they can kill him, so they could be ready for him. Because the one thing that King always did was it's sort of the legacy that everybody ignores, is he actually was very big on trying to call attention to crimes and the failure of the FBI to adequately investigate them. That, as much as anything, by the way, is why J. Edgar Hoover hated him. Because he would publicly call them out. And so these folks thought, oh, you know, if we kill Ben Chester White, oh, we'll just get Kane to go, you know, 50 miles out of his way, and he'll come and he'll do some speech, and then we'll kill him. And it didn't work. So they keep on trying to figure out ways of killing him. They're going to kill him on a bridge. They're going to try and kill him. They tried to kill him when he came to do the eulogy for the four children who died in the Birmingham bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. And the only reason why they didn't pull that off was because he was literally surrounded by too many people and they couldn't get their sights on him, literally. So, and again, if the House Select Committee looks at these folks and says, oh, well, these guys are all different Ku Klux Klan organizations. What they should have done is look at the specific people involved and said, oh, these folks are Christian Identity.
So I guess we've been building up to this. I think we have sort of given a motive, right, for why these organizations would be involved in the assassination. And we've pointed out that there were other plots by these white supremacists.
Right. And these other plots, if I can add, and I'm sorry to interrupt, because the one thing I want to put a ribbon on. Several of them, if it's not clear already, the thought process is it's not just killing King because he's a threat to the Southern way of life. It's killing King because even attempting to kill King, May of 1963, creates riots in places that there hadn't been riots before. And these folks want their accelerationists in the modern parlance. They want to incite their race war.
So in that regard, so we have all these other attempts. Why in 68? What is the key evidence for you that says it was just like these other attempts and it was not James Earl Ray working alone? What convinced you of that?
So first off, it's the argument I said before. Ray's entire MO, his whole entire life, is he's motivated by money. And we do have that sheet and that note in from prison with his handwriting where he's talking about money. We have Ray stalking Martin Luther King, which is a part of the bounty offer. There's two roles to the bounty offer that was offered to Don Nissen in prison. One is to stalk King for a small sum of money. The other one is to actually participate directly in the plot to kill King for a much larger sum of money. We have Ray going to places where these groups had representatives. Now, we don't have Ray directly meeting with somebody in the Ku Klux Klan, but we have two things. We have a compelling case that right before Ray started to stalk King in 1968, in February and March, he gets a meeting with a guy who goes by the alias James C. Harden. This is the people at the motel he's staying with report this. And we were actually able to identify who Harden is. And Harden, you know, your file's not going to say you're Dixie Mafia. His profile fits Dixie Mafia type person to a T. He's a career criminal who is involved in the kinds of sort of interstate crime activity that the Dixie Mafia is known for. But the other interesting thing about James C. Harden, whose real name is James Wilborn Ashmore, is that his license plate was recorded as being one of the cars at the Ole Miss race riots in 1963, which puts him into the sort of framework of, you know, we're inside the sphere of influence of a group like the White Knights. Now, we don't have – the other thing we have, and we developed in 1968, is that the $100,000 bounty offer was being, again, as I said, circulated through more than one prison system. We were able to trace in our latest edition of the book a bounty offer at the same time for the same amount of money that was being offered in Atlanta prisons to the same people who we believe were behind the bounty offer that ultimately goes to Mississippi and to the prison system in Leavenworth in Kansas, right? They tie to somebody, or we can tie that $100,000 bounty offer to somebody who knew James Earl Ray personally and was close to James Earl Ray before he escaped. And we show that that person, his name is Louis Dauda, made a very mysterious trip to California in the winter, or the late, you know, November and December of 1967. And without, I don't want to go into too many details, you get into the book, but it's very clear that Dauda is trying to find James Earl Ray. And Dauda would have had direct access to several of the people who we believe are trying to raise the money, including and offer it in prison systems to kill King. So we believe that Ray found out about a bounty from Dauda, who is located in Georgia. That's where James Earl Ray eventually shows up. And just as compelling is what I was saying before. James Earl Ray's choice of attorneys after the assassination. He does not have to take on J.B. Stoner. He does not have to take on Jack Kershaw. And probably just as suspicious as his effort to try and get Stoner is his failed effort to try and get an attorney out of Mississippi by the name of Percy Quinn. And he sends his brother to go find Percy Quinn. Now, a few things you need to know about Percy Quinn. First off, Percy Quinn doesn't even have a listed phone number or an office in Mississippi. So if you found him, there's a big question as to who turned you on to Percy Quinn. Well, we know the one group of people who would know what Percy Quinn is, to find Percy Quinn, are the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of Mississippi. Why? Because he was basically almost exclusively their attorney. Why is James Earl Ray, who again has access already to some pretty good attorneys, why is he sending his brother on a mission to find the attorney for the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of Mississippi? Why did he ultimately take a meeting with J.B. Stoner? Where was J.B. Stoner on April 4th, 1968? Literally dancing in the streets with who? Members of the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan of Mississippi. What did J.B. Stoner do right after that, by the way? He hires James Earl Ray's brother to be his assistant in the National States Rights Party. And Jerry Ray is a member of the National States Rights Party working and getting paid by J.B. Stoner for years. All of that reeks of suspicion. And I'll add one last thing. James Earl Ray frees up every one of his attorneys when the House Select Committee resumes, has its investigation 10 years after the assassination. He won't let one attorney testify. He asserts attorney-client privilege for only one of his attorneys, and he had like 10. And that was J.B. Stoner. So I will be the first to admit that we don't have James Earl Ray in a room getting a bounty offer from a Dixie Mafia member. But I can show you that he had connections with Ray Dauda, who undoubtedly is connected to this plot. And I can show you that he had connections with James Wilburn Ashmore right before he started to stalk King, and Ashmore sure as heck fits the profile of a Dixie Mafia member. Add that up with what Ray did with his attorneys afterwards, And to me, it's a very compelling circumstantial case.
Now,
Ray, I mean, I could give you the, what I would argue is the evidence for Ray's connection to these groups is circumstantial, pretty strong, I would say. But the evidence that these groups were doing very suspicious things in the year and months and even weeks before King's assassination as completely independent lines of evidence is also very compelling. And we go through that in the book.
Now, the last thing I want to touch on, we've been talking about Christian identity. Now, when people talk about Christian identity within domestic terrorism scholarship, most people think of Christian identity as first gaining steam in the 1980s with groups like the Order or the Bruderschweigen, the Silent Brotherhood. They were engaged in multiple assassinations, bank robberies. I believe they assassinated Alan Berg. There was a movie made by Oliver Stone about it called Talk Radio.
Yeah, really good movie.
And there was also another organization, I believe, that was a Christian identity was the Covenant, the Sword, and the Arm of the Lord, which actually had the materials, I believe, for polluting or a chemical attack on water supplies. I mean, this was serious business. So is there a line that connects that 80s Christian identity to the Christian identity terrorism you're referring to?
100%. So that is my biggest beef with the contemporary groups of scholars on domestic right-wing terrorism. I give them credit. Bruce Hoffman, who is maybe the dean of expertise on domestic terrorism, someone who I respect a lot, and I used his research a lot in my books. He by late 1980s, he publishes a pamphlet on domestic terrorism. And he says that first of all, worth noting, by far the plurality of pages in that book are devoted to right-wing terrorism and not just, you know, like the PLO. So it wasn't just about domestic terrorism, it was about terrorism, but the large majority was about domestic right-wing terrorism. Every single group, he asserts, in the 1980s, every single one is under the influence of Christian identity. Every domestic terrorist group, including, as you said, the Covenant, Sword, and Arm of the Lord, including the Order. But where are they getting their ideas from, right? So a lot of these groups, their influence, Christian identity goes back to 1945, right? Everyone admits that. Everyone admits that the sort of chief apostle is a guy by the name of Wesley Swift. Wesley Swift is a minister out of California. He has a hugely popular radio show with the right-wing sort of extremist community out of California, and then he has a whole entire tape network throughout the 50s and 60s promoting Christian identity ideology. He creates the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, which is a Christian identity church. Well, the Christian, you know, another group that was very active in the 1980s was the Aryan Nations, widely regarded as a threatening group in terms of domestic terrorism. What's their church? The Church of Jesus Christ Christian. Their leader, Richard Butler, was an understudy from Wesley Swift. The Christian identity beliefs, certainly, of the people in the Covenant, Sword, and Arm of the Lord and in the Order go back to people that they were studying since the 70s, and all of them were influenced by Wesley Swift. And so, certainly, you go to a group like the Posse Comitatus. Well, who started them? That was William Potter Gale. William Potter Gale is one of Wesley Swift's closest lieutenants. He was the Reverend William Potter Gale, right? So, in some cases, I can get you from some groups, you know, 1 to 2 steps removed for some of these folks. but almost all of them took their, at least their spiritual influence from somebody who in the 1960s had a group called the Christian Defense League, which the FBI records are very clear was a terrorist organization that had plotted numerous terrorist attacks. They are heavily influenced by a group called the Minutemen, who in the 1960s plotted numerous, what would have been large-scale attacks. And members of those groups go on to seed and inspire other groups like the Covenant Sword and Arm of the Lord. And you can, for instance, the whole idea of having a cell-based terrorist organization, by the way, more recently, I can show you that goes back to early 1970s, but it's generally the person who popularized that was a guy by the name of Louis Beam. So he's sort of the guy who's the strategist for right-wing domestic terrorism. Well, Louis Beam comes up under the tutelage and influence of a guy named James Warner and David Duke, and amongst other people. Well, those guys, I mean, James Warner was a minister who worked directly with somebody like Wesley Swift. So again, it clearly the ideas go back and are seeded by all of these people. But more than that, it goes in waves. And this is what I really wish people would understand. You have a rise in domestic right-wing terrorism influenced, I believe, in part in the 60s by Christian identity ideas. And then you get a combination of government crackdowns and fragmentation when Wesley Swift dies. And these groups fragment out and they become much quieter. And then they get reinfused by a new generation of leaders and more complacency on the part of the government. And then they come back in the late 1970s. So they were never, the ideas dormant and then resurfaces. And that's a big part of my book, America's Secret Jihad. But there's to say that that Christian identity starts in 1945 with Wesley Swift and that nothing happens until 1980, that's what people should be skeptical of. And again, I think I show very clearly that clearly people with Christian identity ideas were engaged in terrorism, like Sam Bowers and J.B. Stoner. The difference is that in order to get a larger group of people to help them with the violence, to create their race war, they had to be less open about what their true agenda really was. They had to align themselves in ways to get what they wanted done, which mostly involved targeting Black people. But the entire time they were looking to throw gas on the fire of racial unrest in the United States, and they did that in the late 50s and throughout the 60s, it tampers down in the 1970s as a combination, again, of law enforcement and the death, in my opinion, of Wesley Swift, and then reemerges again in the late 1970s. It was always there, but it reemerges in the late 70s, early 80s, in cell-based groups who knew the legacy. This is what these folks, I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot here, but Louis Beam promotes this idea of cell-based terrorism. Why? Because large-scale organization-based terrorism has been too thoroughly infiltrated by the feds. Okay, so the question the scholar should be asking is, where is he getting that from? If it started with the order, what large group is he referring to? He is basing it on the experience of, in my opinion, the Klan groups from the 1960s. They were the groups that were broken apart.
So the type of people that were behind the Mississippi burnings, and in your contention, the assassination of Martin Luther King.
100%. And they're constantly, and unfortunately even to this day, trying to add fuel to race war ideas. Only nowadays, the level of infiltration is such, I think it's been renewed. I was really worried it was going to become organizational in nature. I was actually heartened to see what happened to the base. But it's more lone type of people. And I hate using lone nuts because they're heavily influenced by ideology that's being promoted.
Well, even lone wolves are influenced by stochastic terrorism.
Right, 100%. But with very much the same agenda to put gasoline on the fire so that they can create their race war.
I guess I want to kick it over to Casey. I also think we should address this really quickly because I know I'm going to have a few listeners, and I understand where they're coming from, that feel very strongly that Martin Luther King was killed by the feds. And I part of me understands that because I think the civil rights movement really angered people like J. Edgar Hoover. So I understand where they're coming from. How would you respond?
A few ways. The first thing I would say is, if you had told me that the feds had killed Martin Luther King in 1964 or 65, I'd be a lot more open to it from a motive perspective. And the reason why is the degree to which the civil rights movement very astutely capitalized on the Cold War context to try and get what they needed. In other words, they're one of the as a cohort of people, they're as brilliant in terms of practical politics as any group of people we've had since the founding of the country. And they realized that the way you could get indifferent people like, frankly, John Kennedy in 1961 and 62, later he has a change of heart, to listen to what you're doing is by embarrassing the United States on the world stage. Kind of hard to go to non-aligned countries in places like Africa and tell them that the American way is the best way when they're seeing a bus of people being blown up with an attempt to burn them alive during the freedom rides. And the people in the civil rights movement knew this keenly. They weren't just socializing the conflict in the United States. They were doing it worldwide. So if you told me that King was going to be killed in 64 and 65, I'd take that very seriously. He was clearly being very heavily watched and surveilled, and even beyond 65. But, and this gets to the point that you were making earlier, context changes in 68. In a couple of really key ways. First off, the typical argument is, first of all, he wasn't, if anything, King was the one person within the civil rights movement, if you're anyone than virtually J. Edgar Hoover, who you'd rather be dealing with in 1968.
He wasn't Malcolm X.
Right, he wasn't Malcolm X, he wasn't Elijah Muhammad, and most importantly in 68, he wasn't Stokely Carmichael. And if you look at the Fear of a Black Messiah document from 1968, it's often bantied around, we must neutralize a potential Black Messiah. The person that they say is the threat isn't King. They throw his name out. They throw out Elijah Muhammad, but the person that they're worried about is Stokely Carmichael. And they say we don't have to worry about King as long as he at least maintains the pretense of nonviolence. Of course, it wasn't a pretense, but that's how they phrased it, right? And this gets to a really important point. By 68, first off, the nation's attitude towards Vietnam had started to shift. So the argument you're going to kill King because of Vietnam doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me when the president of the United States has had to, the most ambitious possibly we've ever had, has had to quit the race because Vietnam is going so poorly and because the country has largely started to turn against it by April of 68. The second contention, what you are concerned about, even more possibly than the Vietnam War, if you're the Pentagon or the national security state, is domestic unrest. You had major mainstream magazines running articles about the potential for a flat-out revolution, race-based even, inside the United States. And why? Because for the previous 3 years leading up to 1968, it was an ever-escalating series of increasingly violent and dangerous urban riots that were then starting to be matched by the intensity of anti-war riots, as well as radicalization of some of the anti-war and other groups in the country. The thing you were worried about in 68, and we can document, they had programs in place and that they were building specifically to deal with the country in the event that we fell into some kind of massive civil, sectarian, racial type of war. The last thing you would do in 68, with that as your background context, is kill Martin Luther King. And this isn't just presentism on my part. If, again, you look at the people who they were really concerned about, it was the Black Panthers. It wasn't King. King was a personal hobby horse for J. Edgar Hoover. But J. Edgar Hoover had, and we're starting to see it now, he had stuff in his blackmail, bribery, slander arsenal that he had yet to unleash on King. And King, I can tell you from somebody who knew him and talked with him not long before he died, King was fully expecting for J. Edgar Hoover to put out all the stops and completely ruin his reputation. And King expected that his reputation may well be ruined by the time it was done. And bravely decided to continue moving forward with the Poor People's Campaign. But to say it again, to kill King at the lowest ebb of his influence, when he's the last remaining voice for nonviolence, at a time when you're obsessed with the possibility of widespread domestic unrest, the kind of unrest that you've already been experiencing for the past 3 years, would be the exact opposite of what that national security state would have wanted to do in 1967 and 1968. In contrast, any of the people that I am talking about, not only could they, I document that they did, see the opportunity of the racial unrest in the country as the ticket and even as a cosmic religious sign that they could get their race war. And you know what? For a couple of weeks after King got killed, it looked like they were right. So again, you really have to drill down to what was happening in April of 68. And a lot of the, I would argue, almost purely motive-based arguments. There's nothing even approaching the kind of direct evidence that we have for white supremacist Dixie Mafia plot in favor of a government plot, except if you go by James Earl Ray, who is a notorious liar, and who this grand government conspiracy, which in the words of one of his attorneys, William Pepper, includes the killing of King, the killing of Kennedy. Raoul, in James Earl Ray's lawyer's rendition, is the assassin not only of MLK, but JFK. James Earl Ray can identify the government agent who killed the president and the most important civil rights leader of our time, and they can't even kill James Earl Ray in prison.
Well, I was just going to add, I'd even heard that Ray was telling some people that, I know he fed to this far right-wing journalist, Michael Collins Piper. He was feeding him stuff saying, oh yeah, the Mossad was actually behind it. So, I mean, yeah, Ray is not a trustworthy, yeah.
He changes his story all the time. And it's very obvious what he's doing is he's playing on, I said he had two groups of attorneys. The other group was kind of a new left group, some of whom, you know, I have huge amounts of admiration for, like Jim Lazar.
But James Earl Ray played into what I would argue is justifiable suspicion that these folks had, stemming especially from what happened to John Kennedy. And he played right into it. Like, he basically says, after Jim Garrison goes on Johnny Carson in the early 70s to say, you know, here's a picture of the tramps in Dealey Plaza, James Earl Ray magically comes out and says, you know, one of them looks remarkably like Raul. And wow, isn't that a coincidence? Of course, we later find out the exact names of the tramps, and they're actual tramps. But it didn't stop James Earl Ray from saying, apparently to some researchers, that this is remarkable resemblance. Well, James Earl Ray is given the world's worst photo lineup of all time in the 1990s and identifies the person he says is Raul. And I do this experiment with students and with other people. I put up the picture of the tramp, we call him Frenchie, and I put up the picture of the person that James Earl Ray says is Raul. And I ask people, do you think that the photo on the left bears a remarkable resemblance to the photo on the right? And they don't, because they don't look anything alike. James Earl Ray positively identified somebody who looks nothing like the person he said remarkably looks like Raul in the early 70s. He was feeding his attorneys what they wanted to hear. And, you know, again, his whole scam the entire time was to get out, get his money. And the needle he had to thread was he had to convince people of his innocence, at the same time take the web of suspicion away from, and give, and more than anything, give confidence to the white supremacist type people that they could rely on him not to rat them out or rat out the people who could ultimately lead to them.
Casey, I know you were really interested in this book, Killing King. I want to give you the final word or any final questions you maybe want to ask Stuart.
I really don't have any final questions. It's more based on just what we were just talking about. You know, I have no love for any of the alphabet agencies, but at the end of the day, it seems like the evidence indicates, as in most cases when it comes to government conspiracies, it seems to be a conspiracy to cover up how badly they messed up. And you know, that's just how it is, apparently.
And again, and I believe we established it was also came out after the book, that after the last publication, probably the single biggest thing that came out afterwards was confirmation that the person who I've suspected for 10 years was a government informant inside the Ku Klux Klan and somebody who is very clearly somebody who shows up in the documents as being a part of what looks like a plot by the White Knights to kill Martin Luther King, that he was a government informant. And that would mean that the FBI had a government informant deep inside the plot that ultimately killed King. And I don't think they let it happen or participated, but I sure as hell think they didn't take it seriously enough to stop it. And that would be a huge scandal that clearly, when you add it up with what they've already known from Donald Nissen and other, you know, and other files on other plots, makes it look like they did at the best, a really, really bad job of trying to keep Martin Luther King alive. So, and that would be all the reason they need to cover it up. It's all the reason they needed to cover up what they knew about the Birmingham bombing. So.
Well, I want to thank you, Stuart Wexler, co-author with Larry Hancock of Killing King, for coming on Parallax Views. Casey, why don't you lead us out?
Stay safe, stay strong, stay out of Memphis, I guess. Solidarity forever.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Stuart Wexler, co-author with Larry Hancock of Killing King, Racial Terrorists, James Earl Ray, and the Plot to Assassinate Martin Luther King Jr. Let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@protonmail.com. Normally, I would make a plug for the Parallax Views Patreon page. If you'd like to contribute, please visit patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. But listen, that's all I'm going to say about the Patreon on this episode. I just want to say that we need to really remember George Floyd. Remember George Floyd. Remember his name and say his name, folks. We can't let incidents like this continue to happen. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.